Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to our Christmas Books Podcast. And yes, in true festive spirit, we've even got some carols for you by the aptly named Carol Ann Duffy, no less. Ah, oh, isn't that lovely? There's nothing like a glockenspiel at Christmas. More carols later. And we'll be finding out how Carol Ann managed to persuade 25 other poets to write brand new carols for this week's Guardian Review. It's also, of course, the season for last-minute present buying. So I've been doorstepping Guardian and Observer writers for the books they've most enjoyed this year.
It'll enable you to speak to the birds. It's the most beautiful thing.
It's an accounting of his life within the context of the extraordinary landscape of northwest Scotland, and I just loved it.
It's brilliantly weird.
And you could imagine him as Professor Z of Princeton University in years to come.
Essentially a morality tale with lots of wine and sex and cute animals. So it's kind of quite Christmassy, really.
But first, one of my Twitter correspondents this week described Dave Eggers as a shed writer. I've no idea what that means, but it sounds good. And it's just the sort of word that Jonathan Green would love. He has produced as fine a three-volume dictionary of slang as you would desire to piss upon. That's actually not an insult, but early 18th century slang for excellent or first rate. He came in to talk to our own Lindsay Irving. And the first question Lindsay asked him was why, oh why?
It's so difficult. I have been actually trying to write stuff because I've set up a website. Why do I do it? Where did I start? I wonder whether there's all sorts of things. Is it because I want to swear in front of my mother, as it were? Is it that I want to, you know, the love of words? But that's so loose because everybody loves words one way or another, or most people do. I'm inclined to think that it's because of some of the books that I read when I was quite young, 10, 11, like Damon Runyon's Guys and Dolls, as Penguin had put some of the stories together. This would be back in the late 50s. Just excited me, maybe not even consciously, but it began to seem, and I made my way through my prep school library, and people like Sapper and Woodhouse and so on and so forth, and it began to appear to me that the interesting words were not standard English, although again, I wouldn't have known the phrase standard English. I'm not even sure if I'd have known the word slang, but the small s sexy stuff was what would turn out to be the slang, or so it appeared to me.
And how did the project sort of develop from that early interest into what must have been, I mean, you must have had a lot of people working on this eventually?
Well, my predecessor was Eric Partridge, who was the word king, as he was apostrophised, I believe, for basically the second half of the 20th century. Indeed, more than that. His first dictionary came out in 1937, and that was the Dictionary of Slang and Unconventional English. And by the time we got to the 70s, 80s, when I was joining the party, it became obvious to me that Partridge, for all his skills, he was an old man. He did not get the things that I had grown up with, the teenage culture, rock and roll, drugs, things of that nature. He simply didn't get it. And I thought to myself, aha, I will propose, I think it was called The Dictionary of Contemporary Slang. And I did a book which was, I think, 11,500 head words, based on English slang and American slang and Australian slang, in other words, Anglophone slang, from 1945 onwards. Now, that 11,500 headwords, this is serious juvenilia, because they are not enough to fit into all the headwords in the letter S now. I mean, it's a different ballgame. I know a lot more about what I do, and so I certainly should. But that book was good. And the other thing that Eric Partridge had not done, it wasn't that he didn't get it, he made a conscious decision to avoid it, was to put in American slang. And to be perhaps clichéd, but we all talk American slang now. In fact, not only do we all talk American slang, we all talk black ghetto slang. When I say we all, what I really mean is young people. But
for whom? Yeah, slang is a young
black
person's
and white
vocabulary.
Young and certainly I would say people under 30, and of course in the way of these things you grow older and you take your slang with you. But we've been talking black ghetto slang for much longer than hip-hop, much longer than rap. I was talking it when I was a hippie and using words like groovy and bag and heavy and cool and uptight and stuff of that nature. In my naivety, I didn't realise this, and I'm not sure that many of us did. But these were old jazz words from the 20s and 30s. I mean, this was old, old stuff. And the black world was probably at the time, or would have been, talking to an extent rather differently.
One thing which is striking looking at your dictionary, which gathers 500 years of vocabulary in it, is how remarkably consistent the themes of the slang vocabulary are. Sex, money, crime, and overlapping bits of those two areas. Why do you think that those preoccupations are so consistent?
Well, I don't think so. Well, I think slang, I have put in my introduction that slang basically is the linguistic id rather than the ego or the superego. It's our downside, you could say. I would say it is our most human side. And we don't do in slang caring, sharing and compassion. It doesn't come into the game. What we do is insulting other people. What we do is racism. What we do is looking, because it's a very man-made language, what we do is looking at women as sexual objects. I don't think there are very many terms in the book that look at women in a positive way, except, I suppose, if you're willing to go with this, the ones that equate them to something good enough to eat, sweetie, honey, all the rest of it, that kind of stuff. But basically, it deals with self-indulgence. It deals with drink, and drink segues into drugs in the mid-20th century. It deals with bigging yourself up. It deals with putting other people down. Criminality, obviously, deals with sex, parts of the body, what we do with them, commercial sex, and so on. I think you can see where I'm going.
Yes, and as I was saying earlier, we tend to think of slang as kind of an evanescent vocabulary. But another interesting thing from the book is how certain words hang around in the slang vocabulary for centuries.
The perfect example of a real veteran is the word booze. I mean, you find booze. All right, booze is spelt B-O-O-Z-E. And when you actually find it in its earliest incarnation, it's spelled B-O-W-S-E. But so what? I mean, it first turns up, I believe, in... It's in Thomas Harman's Caveat for Common Cursiters, which came out in 1566. And there it is, a something of Ben Bowes, good drink. And it's lasted. Why it's lasted, I do not know, except for it is a central word in one of the most central of all slang's themes. I mean, there was a man called Greg who I think wrote in the Edinburgh Review in 1938, the chief stimuli of slang are sex, money and intoxicating liquor. And I would suggest that if you factor in drugs, ain't nothing changed. But also you can see this even in the criminal language back in 1531 when a man called Copeland did a book called, well, a tiny little glossary called The Highway to the Spittle House, in which he allegedly stood outside Bart's Hospital near where I live. It gives me a lot of pleasure to pass it by and think of him. And talking to the porter and saying, well, there's all these beggars hanging around, sort of bits dropping off them, God knows what else, and they're all talking this strange jabber. And what does it all mean? And the porter allegedly told him, and he came out with 50 head words. I came out with rather more. Time has passed. Doesn't make me better, but it makes slang larger.
Jonathan Green. Green's Dictionary of Slang, all 6,200 pages and 1.5 million words of it, is published by Chambers. At a recommended retail price of £295, it would make a very special Christmas present for the sesquipedalian in your life. But if you're looking for something a little cheaper, here are some more of the books our writers would point your way.
I'm Madeline Bunting, and the book that I absolutely loved was At the Lock of the Green Corrie by Andrew Gree. I found it the most wonderful meditation on landscape and language, and from that, you know, what are the limits of language? And of course, it's written in honour of Norman McCaig, so that then led me to discover the poet Norman McCaig. And wrapped into it, of course, was this extraordinary sort of personal quest to sort of understand what Grieg's life at this midway point had sort of amounted to. It's an accounting of his life within the context of the extraordinary landscape of northwest Scotland, and I just loved it.
My name's Aditya Chakraborty. I'm the economics leader writer for The Guardian. But since it's Christmas, I won't insist that you read anything on economics. The book I'll recommend is called Whistling Vivaldi by a social psychologist called Claude Steele. The title comes from an essay written by an American journalist called Brent Staples. Brent Staples was a black PhD at the University of Chicago in the 70s, when black PhD students were still quite rare. And what he noticed was that when he walked around Chicago, especially late at night, that white people would cross the road, they'd back away, they'd look at him with fear. So to try and calm them down, what he would do is he would take to whistling Vivaldi. It became a kind of oral cowbell, a kind of human cowbell that he wore to try and reassure other people that he meant no harm. And from that, what Claude Steele does in this book is show the ways that stereotype, what he calls stereotype threats, still weigh upon black and Asian people, whether in America or Britain, and how they try and deal with them, sometimes in quite tortured ways. And why I think that book is particularly relevant is because we're coming to a point in debates about race and sexism too, in which people say that the old debates about material disadvantage, about lack of access to big institutions, whether in jobs or education, those sorts of issues are no longer so big as they used to be. And yet what Claude Steele's book reminds us is actually racism is still real. It just finds different ways of expressing itself.
I'm Jackie Ashley, columnist with The Guardian. The book I really enjoyed this year, rather to my surprise, has been Tony Blair's autobiography. I was expecting the usual sort of self-justification about everything he did, but it was strangely revelatory. All sorts of flashes of honesty, like how he was terrified before Prime Minister's questions, about how he lay in bed with Cherie one morning and announced he was going to be leader of the Labour Party, and about his real doubts and fears over Iraq, although obviously there was a justification too. I found it strangely honest for a politician. Most memoirs tend to gloss over their doubts. But Tony Blair this time, and it was in his own voice, you could tell, because the prose was his own prose, in his own voice, and I found it absolutely a fascinating read. As I say, very much to my surprise. He admitted he'd been on a journey. A lot of us have been wondering what happened to that Tony Blair we remembered from before he became Labour leader, and he admitted he'd gone on this journey and took us along with him, and sort of, in a way, it confirmed all we'd been thinking about him watching his premiership. But I found it a fascinating read.
My name is John Vidal, and I'm the environment editor here. The one book which has inspired me more than any actually only came in a few weeks ago, and it's called Ow to Zzzd, and it's the words of birds. It's the first ever lexicon of bird words. So for the first time, we see written out the birds, all the birds of the world, and what they actually say. So we have quick, 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 skier, which is the dotterel. Quick, quick, quack, which is the mallard. Quirr, the gadwall. Cuck, 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 the green woodpecker, and so on and so forth. There's 800 birds, and all it'll enable you to speak to the birds. It's the most beautiful thing, and it's written by a poet called John Beavis.
Hello, I'm Simon Huttonstone, and I'm a Guardian Features writer. The book that I want to suggest is Jay-Z's Decoded, which is an autobiography, and I had to go and interview Jay-Z this year, and beforehand I knew very little about him. But it is an astonishing life story, and it's quite easy to read. But as well as being that and talking about his drug dealing days, etc., and how he ended up living the American dream, it's a brilliant deconstruction of rap and his lyrics. And you could imagine him as Professor Z of Princeton University in years to come.
I'm Jess Cartner-Morley. I'm fashion editor of The Guardian. There are three books that I've really enjoyed this year. The first one is Laurie Moore, A Gate at the Stairs, which is a beautiful book, very, very sad, but very, very funny. And one of those books which you're just really enjoying for the language, and then 100 pages in, it turns into a completely different book in your hands. It reminded me of the Siri Hustvedt book, what I loved in that way. Another book that I loved was Maggie O'Farrell, The Hand That First Held Mine, which is really interesting about family life, a really fantastic evocation of 1960s London, and just a great yarn as well. And thirdly, I can't leave out Jilly Cooper, Jump, which was absolutely my book that got me through the fashion shows in September. The thing about Jilly Cooper is that this book, like all her others, is essentially a morality tale with lots of wine and sex and cute animals. So it's kind of quite Christmassy, really. It's just brilliant.
Ooh, Jess, you cheat. I particularly love the sound of Or to Zed, if that's how you say it. It's published by America's MIT Press and therefore it entirely passed me by. So good spot, John, thanks. Now, back to those carols. With me in the studio to talk about them is Lisa Allardyce, editor of Guardian Review. Lisa, before we hear some of the carols, can you explain to us exactly what they're from?
They're from a CD of Manchester Carols, a sequence of new Christmas carols written in 2007 by now poet laureate Carol Ann Duffy. And put to music and sung by her friend Sasha Johnson Manning. I think they were premiered that year.
Yeah, the Manchester Carols retell the Christmas story for the 21st century. And being Carol Ann Duffy, of course, they are not ordinary. They are reimagined from the point of view of people who don't necessarily believe in Christianity or any other particular religion. Let's just listen to one. And this is the opening track of the CD, and it's called The Carol Singer's Carol. That was the Carol Singer's Carol from the Manchester Carols, which features the Manchester Carolers and the Northern Chamber Orchestra conducted by Richard Tanner, and it's out on Naxos. Lisa, Carol Ann's not the only poet who's into carols, is she?
Carol Ann has done another wonderful curatorial job for Review, and we have an incredibly festively appropriate 25 carols.
What sort of poets are they?
We have everybody from Sean O'Brien, Jackie Kay, Michael Longley, Alice Oswald.
Well, are they taking it seriously, or is this just a big sort of parlour game for poets?
Some of them are very serious. Sean O'Brien's, which is set to the tune of In a Bleak Winter, is a political poem and is very modern in that sense. Jackie Kay has a lot of fun with Jingle Bells, which I'm not sure officially counts as a carol, but she tells jingle bells in a broad Glaswegian accent along the lines of Ooch jing ma bell.
Ooch jing ma bell, jing ma bell. Excuse us, anybody who's Scottish, we're just in rather high spirits here.
Caroline Duffy herself has written one. She's got a bit of an obsession with bees at the moment, and hers is called The Bee Carol.
But there aren't any bees in Christmas. It's rather unseasonal, isn't it?
These are exceptionally Christmassy bees.
I just want to go back a little bit to Sean O'Brien's carol, because I just think this is really clever, because the whole point of the Christina Rossetti is that it's by someone who is poor, and the key words are poor as I, what shall I give him, poor as I am. And this is spoken by a rich man. I think that's really brilliant. And it's looking at the poor from the point of view view of somebody who sees them as a waste of time.
Absolutely. And The Bleak Midwinter was based on a poem written by Christina Rossetti in 1872, I think.
So that takes us back into the whole idea of the history of poets getting involved with hymns and carols. So she wrote it for a competition, didn't she?
Yeah, by Scribner's Monthly. I only know this because Carol Ann tells us in her introduction. She also tells us that her predecessor as poet laureate, the Irish poet Nahum Tate, he wrote While Shepherds Watch Their Flocks by Night in 1703.
Oh, my goodness. All those years singing while shepherds washed their socks. He would be turning in his grave, wouldn't he? But I suppose there's no publicity like publicity. I particularly actually like Michael Symonds Roberts' Midwife's Carol. And I wondered whether it was because he is Christian and he really seems to believe in it. And it has this, I'm just going to read you this little stanza. My hands have cradled many heads, cut countless cords and calls, but never held eternity within such fragile walls. Isn't that lovely?
I think my favourite is Alice Oswald, Slow Down Blackbird. Which is a nature poem, as Alice Oswald often writes about nature, which is blackbird fretting in the frozen hedge in the first slow fall of the year when wind, struck in a slow drift, lags behind the twilight's trailing edge.
So there you go. The Guardian Review carols can be read as a parlour game, but you can actually take them as seriously as you want. The really playful part of this week's review, which is the last of the year because we miss an edition on Christmas Day, is the quiz at the back. But before we get to that, let's have a couple more recommendations, this time from our culture team.
I'm Willis Skidelsky, literary editor of The Observer, and my book of the year is The Collected Stories of Lydia Davis. I didn't know anything about her before I read this. Her work's never really been published before in Britain. She's a short story writer, and she writes unusual stories in that they tend to be very short, some of as short as just a single sentence. So as a reader, you really have to completely adjust your expectations of what a story should be. But once you do this, and it takes a while, her stories are wonderfully readable. They're funny, clever, linguistically ingenious, and often quite moving. My favourite story of all by her is called The Race of the Patient Motorcyclists, which imagines a motorbike race, the purpose of which isn't to go as fast as possible, but to go as slowly as possible. It's brilliantly weird.
This is Lisa Allardyce, editor of Guardian Review. My book of the year is a bit of a cheat insofar as it was actually written in 1945 but released as a Penguin Classics paperback this year. It is Alone in Berlin by Hans Fallada, who died shortly after writing it. It's the story of one man or one couple, Otto and Anna, their resistance against the Nazi regime. And it was based on a true story about a working class couple who for 2 years had a campaign of writing and distributing postcards with anti-Hitler and anti-SS messages around the city. And it is the most harrowing story. None of the characters are particularly attractive, but it's impossible not to be moved by their heroism. It's heartbreaking and everyone should read it.
I'm Paul Leite. I'm deputy editor of Review, and my choice is Whoops by John Lanchester, a book about the financial crisis, which, given the depressing subject matter, given the fact that we're still suffering from those panicky days, what happened in those panicky days of September 2008, has no right to be as entertaining as it is. But it's witty, it's fun, it's fantastically written, and it's definitely the book that you want to read if you want to understand that parallel universe of risk and derivatives, things which we never really thought that we needed to know about, but since 2008 we realised that we really should know about.
I'm Zan Brooks, associate editor of Guardian.co.uk. I loved Homer and Langley, which is, I guess, a late masterpiece from the great E.L. Doctorow. It's a novel based on the lives of the Collier brothers, who are these well-to-do New York hoarders and hermits who filled their brownstone with 130 tons of flotsam. Doctorow installs the Colliers as kind of these bizarre curators of 20th century American history. But I thought afterwards that you could almost read it as a parable of the 21st century online culture as well. One brother collects clippings, and his aim is to make what he calls the eternal dateless newspaper, which I guess is what the internet is. This is a small, brilliant, melancholy novel that basically inverts America and makes the frontier go inside, like a burrow.
Lisa, hefty little recommendation for you there. I'm quite glad to see that you don't spend all your life trying to trick famous people into playing parlour games for the Guardian Review.
Yes, except we have slightly done it again with our Guardian Review literary quiz this year, which instead of toiling away and scratching our heads and compiling the questions ourselves, we thought we'd ask the experts. And so we've got writers to set their own literary questions, and everybody from Ian Banks, Dilly Cooper, David Hare, Nick Hornby, Laurie Moore and Will Self have all set three brain teasers, and blimey, they're fiendish.
Is there a prize for people who can answer them all?
There is. We have two sets of the five most nominated books of the year this year, which include signed copies of Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, the Stephen Sondheim and Neil McGregor's History of the World in 100 Objects.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be winning it because I've so far got half a point for knowing one of the two forms of birth control that Leopold and Molly Bloom used in James Joyce's Ulysses. Thanks for that question, Will Self. Lisa, how do we enter?
You need to go online where you'll find the questions and send us your answers by midnight on Friday, because all of the answers will be printed along with the complete set of questions in Saturday's review.
And that's on guardian.co.uk/books. And that's it for this podcast. Hopefully we've given you everything you need for a merry, musical and foul-mouthed Christmas. We'll be back on Christmas Eve with the highlights of our first full year of podcasting. But don't despair if you think you're going to miss us. You can still download our series of short stories, which has been going from strength to strength all week. Lisa, what have we got left?
Today, you can listen to Rose Tremaine read young Chinese-American author Yi Yun Lee's story Extra. Tomorrow, Julian Barnes reads Ernest Hemingway's very atypical story, Homage to Switzerland. And then for the rest of the week, we have Helen Dunmore on Frank O'Connor, Ali Smith on Grace Paley, and Helen Simpson finishing off with a wonderful Angela Carter. So if you're making a Christmas pudding, wrapping presents, or just desperate to get away from the Christmassiness, you can listen to any of the 12, or all 12 at the same time, or just as a little Christmas treat for when you fancy it.
That's it from me, Claire Armistead, and from our producer, Pascal Wise, and we wish you a happy listening. For now, we'll play you out with another of the Manchester carols. This one is called The Advent Carol. Oh.